Hey up, and welcome to the Strategy Sessions. My name is Andy Jarvis. I am the host of the show and I run XMO Marketing. I'm here today to just let you know that we're interviewing Daryl Fielding on the podcast. I met Daryl at a conference where I meet most of the guests, to be honest, and was dazzled, amazed, just awe-inspired listening to Daryl tell the story of the Dove campaign. The Real Women, one of the first campaigns to bring real women front and center, as opposed to kind of supermodel chic, which is what was kind of all the rage at the time. It's an amazing story, but more than that, Daryl has been, I think, CMO or Chief Brand Officer at Vodafone. He's now kind of involved in diversifying marketing talent, and he's just superb fun to sit and spend time with. So it was a really enjoyable interview. I hope that comes across. Enjoy the show. Let me know what you think. Hey up, and welcome to the Strategy Sessions. I'm over the moon, delighted, amazed and honoured to be joined today by Daryl Fielding. Daryl, welcome to the Strategy Sessions.
Thank you. And as we would say from my home county, if you do A up, I'm going to go, good morning, my lovers.
Good morning, my lovers. So that will, for the American listeners, and there are a few, they'll be going, what is going on? So you're from the southwest of England.
I am originally from the southwest of England, where that is a very common greeting.
And I understand that the Taylor Swift song, Lovers, was very popular down that part of the world because it just fit perfectly. But I'm not going to sing it. We'll move on.
I didn't know that, well, so I'm pleased to hear it.
There you are. So rather than have one of the world's greatest marketing thinkers here talking about Taylor Swift, although that could be an interesting sideline, let's talk about your career and the things you're involved with and the problem with marketing at the moment as well, which might be an interesting place to start. The problem with marketing at the moment is?
The problem with marketing at the moment is, in my opinion, that we could do a lot better on the capability and the reputation of that discipline. And I think there are two ways to do that. We need to bring in more diverse talent into the industry, and I can talk extensively about that later. But also, you know, kind of re-embrace investing in training people. You know, on a bad day, I would roll my eyes and say that, you know, 90% of UK marketers are feral. Which is probably unkind. But
probably true.
You know, unkind but fair, yeah. Arguably. So I think, you know, at least half of my working life these days is really about, you know, amping up the marketing industry in a way in terms of the people in it and how capable they are.
So diversity is something that is kind of one of the core things I look at in XMO marketing, where not so much as in doing diversity with clients, but about trying to, in a smaller way, broaden the thinkers and the people getting involved in marketing. There's a presentation I have where I spend a couple of minutes telling the audience they're weird and then proving that they're weird. Because when you look at the stats of who's into marketing or who works in marketing agencies particularly, they tend to be very young compared to the UK population, very well educated compared to the rest of the population, from affluent backgrounds compared to the rest of the population. And some people say, why does that matter? But it does, because marketing's job is to sometimes reflect society, isn't it? And it's hard to do that when everybody went to a private school and had the same background.
Yes, well, I mean, the stats on how middle class an industry we are pretty shocking, actually. Mm-hmm. And this is an area of a special interest for me. Both the Social Mobility Foundation and Marketing Week surveys will give the same answer, that 12% of people working in marketing are from working class backgrounds compared to 30%. Mm-hmm. So that's a sort of, you know, 3-1, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and that's, first of all, it's just kind of wrong. So there's nothing, you know, there's nothing wrong with wanting to fix something just because it's wrong.
Absolutely.
It's not fair. And I'm quoted as saying that, you know, the bottom you fall out of at the start of your life should not determine whether you get to work in marketing. And that is what it boils down to. You know, there are some incredibly bright young people out there. Yep. And, you know, they struggle to navigate their way to the marketing industry. Mm-hmm. And the marketing industry is worse off if it only has, you know, it is only populated by middle class people, because their assumptions and, you know, kind of perspectives are not going to reflect the population. Now, I'm not one of these people that thinks, you know, you must be the audience in order to market well, because if you take that to its logical conclusion, mm-hmm. you know, you would never have any men working in lipstick marketing or, yep. or, you know, something like that, or, you know, no men working for Sanpro or something like yep. that. And to be a good marketer, you should be able to understand any target audience. That's yep. really what characterises a brilliant marketer. However, you know, homogenous populations of any kind is not a recipe for success. Mm-hmm. You know, there is enough data out there that diverse teams perform better. And how do you define a diverse team? You know, different people, different viewpoints, different backgrounds, different skills and capabilities, and you bring that together. Yeah. And you have a bit of a Barney in that situation, but you all align around one decision and then you press on with it. And that's what drives, you know, the benefits of diversity. I'm going to quote somebody else who I saw on a conference platform who said diversity is not about being nice. And I think that's something also to make the point, yeah. because it is about an enabler of high performance.
Yeah.
And if you have a diverse team, what that is going to give you by definition is there's going to be some differences. And if you're ever trying to accomplish or debate anything meaningful, then you're going to have some argument. And that can be courteous argument. I'm not advocating for a, you know, bun fight of abuse. But, you know, you are going to have some awkward conversations, some differences of opinion, bringing different perspectives and experiences to that debate or action. But, you know, the whole be greater than the sum of those parts, because you'll get a better outcome. So I think it's about it. Diversity is not about, you know, touchy-feely, cuddly, let's be lovely to everyone, but about bringing people together to accomplish something with quite a lot of argy-bargy in the process.
So there's two points I want to pick up on from there, and the creative tension is one of them, and that's the one I probably want to start with. The other one, just so I don't forget to come back to, is that what does diversity mean and what diversity maybe isn't, but we'll come back to that in a minute. But the creative tensions are, I think, really interesting. I remember as a younger chap than I am now, the first time I was in a meeting where I was asked to critique something somebody had done, I couldn't do it. Mm. I mean, I could tell them something nice about it, and I could blow some smoke up their arse about something else, and even the bits that were terrible, I see it now, and much of it was terrible. Couldn't tell them about it. It just felt like I was being nasty to them.
Right, you couldn't tell them because you didn't dare say it out loud, or you didn't...
I was worried about hurting the feelings, is mainly where I was. And it's only as I've got older and been in environments where... I think the setup becomes important to allow people to be able to critique, but feel safe while they're being critiqued, and also feel safe that you can give that critique to create that creative tension. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about, to create that safer space to allow those discussions to happen?
Absolutely. It is about creating a space where those decisions can happen. And one of the big enablers of that is, well, a couple of things really, inclusive leadership, so whoever's leading that team, you know, manages that conversation well, and manages the people in the room at the time. But you know, kind of also the trust between the people. You know, you have to, if you're creating a team, you know, if they are diverse, you need to create that trust. Great book, one of my favourites, Patrick Lencioni, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, who talks quite a lot about that building of trust in that team. Now, sometimes teams come together relatively quickly for a project, but I still think it's worth the investment of time just to get to know each other a little bit as people, and then to enable that critique. And there is respectful language and a respectful protocol around that that you can create. You know, encouraging people to seek feedback makes it easier to give. And, you know, there's always things like, you know, start with the positive, then move on to, you know, even better if.
Yeah.
And then the other lovely piece of language, which I've learned in the past, is have you considered? You know, can create a sort of vocabulary and a protocol around that feedback that makes it much more comfortable for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, but just an expectation that the purpose of it is to improve the task and trying to sort of decouple it a bit from the person.
Yeah. Tackle the ball, not the man. It's the same football parlance.
Exactly. I'm not very good at sporting metaphors, no, but I'll try. But yes, I think it really is about, you know, focusing on the task and trying not to make it personal,
yeah.
And to encourage and train your people that is what it's about. And one of the things I used to say when we were discussing work, and people would often get very defensive, and this is probably a bit sharp, but it was like, you know, well, we're not, you know, when we run this TV commercial on the television, we're not going to publish a list of apologies as to why it's not better, like credits at the end, are we? You know, we're going to have to make this better. You know, if there's a problem with it, we're going to have to deal with it. We're not going to provide a list of excuses at the conclusion. Mm-hmm. So I think if people get to really understand that this is all about the excellence around the task and everybody signs up for that, then I think that also helps create that culture of you know, the point of all this input is to make the outcome better. Now, this gets me on to another type of meeting, which I am particularly against, which is, you know, we could call it all sorts of things, but as this is going out in America, I will try not to swear. You have a very large meeting and then something is presented and then you go round the room with everybody giving their point of view.
Yeah.
And what you generally find is, you know, that they're all very worried. And it's often people who have no decision rights on any of it.
Yep.
So I used to call them in one of my corporate jobs, not to their faces clearly, but the worried middle.
Right.
You know, I had decision rights on all of the creative work. So I was the person who was going to get my butt kicked if it wasn't any good.
Yeah.
But I'd often have to tell the worried middle what I was up to, and they'd all be incredibly worried about what I was doing. So, you know, I think that the you know, being in a meeting and not being critical to look clever is super, super important. And another company that I worked with had another protocol around it, which I thought was just brilliant, that if you did criticise anything, you were always asked, what do you want instead?
Right. So you had to not just criticise, but improve.
Propose something that was constructive. And that very plain English, what do you want instead, will discourage the if you like the let's call it clever signalling around criticism.
Arsehole behaviour.
I would potentially classify it as that. But you know, if you go round a room, you know, is a brave person who goes, I've nothing to say.
Yes.
That should be okay. You know, or I love it. You know, and I have been in a room and, you know, I've been quite a tearful executive in my day. You know, I've been in a room where I've seen a presentation and I burst into tears because it was so good.
Brilliant.
I've presented to somebody else once who burst into tears because it was so good, you know. Yeah. And so I think that sort of there's that also that sentiment about being able to be the stupid person that just says, I love it.
Yeah.
And that doesn't often get encouraged or enabled, because at the end of the day, you know, you can end up with something impeccably mediocre if you worry away at everything.
Yeah.
That's the big jeopardy of the worried middle.
That's what I was going to ask you. So how do you know the difference? If you're sitting listening to this thinking, we need more of this creative tension, But how do you recognize when you've just moved from a creative tension that's going to improve the process to design by committee that's actually going to make everything worse? What are maybe the signs that something's functioning well and the signs that you've actually gone too far and it's a pile of shit? That's a technical term, by the way.
Yes. Well, I have experienced plenty of that. It's a really good question. I think where you have to keep the debate centred is mostly around, you know, the idea and does it relate to the strategy, mm-hmm. and stop too much fiddling and small stuff. Yeah. If the conversation starts to be quite particular and fiddly, you probably have gone too far. But if it is about the fundamentals of the idea or, mm-hmm. or will it meet the objectives, or major other concerns that maybe nobody has considered, mm-hmm. which you should bring to the table. You know, I've had one or two of those where I've been about to go and do something and somebody has then said, have you considered that, you know, this, this and this? And I'm like, oh, shit, no, I didn't. And stop the whole project,
yep.
because it was just something that had not crossed my mind. So trying to keep it to the bigger picture, I think, yep. is one way. But, you know, at the end of the day, experience helps.
Because,
you know, you have to know what good looks like and you build that up to some degree over time.
The advertising industry, I'm sure, is full. There's one particular story I saw somebody talk about the gorilla from
yes.
Dairy Milk, sorry.
Yes.
The Dairy Milk gorilla, which was one of the greatest campaigns, voted it's in the top five, if not some of the greatest campaigns of all time,
yes.
in the UK at least. And I'll put a link in the show notes if you don't know what I'm talking about. And I've seen someone present about this campaign. And again, there's lots of people who I'm sure claim authorship of this.
Mm.
But said that one of the account managers, someone sort of mid-level in this whole process, kind of took it upon themselves to say, because every time it went up for approval, it was knocked back as in, this is the most ridiculous thing we've ever seen. This mm. isn't how we do advertising.
Mm.
And believed in it so much that pushed it through and through and through and almost put their job on the line.
Mm.
And this wasn't the person who was doing the presentation. He was talking, sort of shining the light on
mm.
someone else.
Mm.
But almost put the job on the line and said, I believe in this so much, it's the thing to do. And there's, you hear sort of stories like this from the advertising world where some sort of bloody-mindedness pushes it through and it ends up being the greatest ad of all time. Because it's not death by a thousand cuts because everyone's there.
Yeah.
Does that, though, become kind of like this mythical story of advertising, that that's how great advertising's done by some bloody-minded creative, and actually that's not really how good advertising works? Or is there a case for sometimes that is the way to do it as well?
Yes, well, I think in order to... Somebody I was presenting to a group of young people about brands, actually, some time back, and one of them said, and I quote, why are most brands such shit? And my answer was, because excellence is hard.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, if it wasn't hard, there would be more of it around. So I think in my career, where everything was effortless, it ended up being a bit mediocre.
Mm-hmm.
And where it did require a level of doggedness and persistence, it did lead to something better and in some instances, greatness. So I think it is about, somebody once said, how do you transform things? Because part of my reputation is taking something that was mediocre and making it great. And I've done that a few times. And I said to the answer to that, you have to listen and not listen. And that's a sort of, it's almost a skill that's a bit...
paradox.
it is a paradox. But you have to have a degree of bloody-mindedness. Because unless you've got that drive, you're not going to battle through the barriers and obstacles to excellence, because there are barriers and obstacles to excellence. On the other hand, being that determined shouldn't close your ears to input and to, you know, feedback. Mm-hmm. And I think those that manage to do something really good have managed to do both, listen and not listen.
Yeah.
And I can't really give you a roadmap to that,
yeah.
other than say, you know, yes, be determined and be driven, but don't be deaf.
Yeah, and I think social media has made
the world think that there is often a clear, pithy answer to every question, isn't there? And that, or that there's a really easy route to every to solve every problem. Mm. And the reality, life is full of paradoxes where, you know, listen and don't listen is perfect advice almost, and the difficult bit is having the experience to understand what to listen to and what to ignore.
You're
selling a course for $3,997 to help with that. No. So before we get on to some of the campaigns you've been in, we'll nudge back to talking about how we changed the marketing industry.
Yes.
The story I was going to tell briefly was about the Chancellors of the Exchequer. We have Jeremy Hunt at the moment, but prior to that, we've had Kwasi Kwarteng, Sajid Javid, and Nazim, I forget his last name, unfortunately. So basically, we've had three
Quite
or four ethnic minority chancellors, which in many ways is something to be proud of and a wonderful impact for the country.
Mm.
However, when you dig into the background of the chancellors, actually what you find is over the last 10 chancellors, there's only been two that weren't privately educated.
Mm.
And when you look at where they were privately educated, I think seven of them went to two schools. Mm. And only one of them, a Labour chancellor that wasn't Gordon Brown, was not part of the same sort of school set.
Yes.
And then you start to look at diversity. So when you were saying earlier, what is diversity?
Mm.
It is a bit of a bugbear of mine where people are like, oh, well, you know, we've got a couple of ethnic minorities on this board, or we have some women.
Mm.
And but if all the women are from the same schooling system as everybody else, or from the same, you know, all the men are from this, that's not really diversity, is it?
No, it isn't. It might look good in a photo,
yes,
but it actually isn't going to be the kind of diversity that it improves performance.
Mm.
And, you know, partly because, you know, I run a charity, the Marketing Academy Foundation, which focuses on young people enabling access to the industry for young people from disadvantaged backgrounds, so the bottom 30% of homes socioeconomically. I'm obviously particularly you know, kind of knowledgeable and focused on that. But I believe that your background is a bigger indicator of whether you're going to bring difference to any particular conversation, and especially when most of the people in it are middle class or even upper class, than what skin colour they have. Now, you know, there will have been experiences because of that ethnicity that people who don't have that ethnicity won't have had.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, do I want to help the children of, you know, African ambassadors get into marketing? Honestly, I don't.
Yeah.
I want to help kids from the block, regardless of what colour they are.
Yeah.
Honestly, that's my shtick on it.
And I love you for it. I think it's fantastic. And I'm always wary of, as probably someone who now fits most middle class caricatures going, but from a working class, we don't talk about class in this country anymore, do we? Politicians talk about honest working people. No one says working class. But I go back to where I grew up on a council estate in Bradford, in a single parent family.
Yep.
Everyone talks about working class.
Yes.
You know,
I think it's one of those things that maybe has been redefined and, you know, kind of layers of political correctness over it. But, you know, we tend to talk about the bottom 30% socioeconomically.
Yeah.
Because we are actually going in the charity, we are focusing on that. And that is even less advantageous than the work definition of working class. And I think, you know, when those terms were coined originally, you know, quite a lot of people didn't work at all.
Mm-hmm.
Almost everybody works now. So it's sort of becoming a little bit less well understood. And if you're, you know, if you're running a charity, you have to be pretty precise about your beneficiary definition. And we are very precise about that.
And I do remember in the 90s, late 90s, studying politics at A level, we had a discussion about class. And the question was something along the lines of, If a builder working class, everybody says yes. Is a teacher middle class, everybody says yes.
Mm.
And says, yeah, but if you're a builder earning £70,000 a year or a teacher earning £30,000 a year, who's middle class?
Mm.
It's not as easy as it was to define maybe in Victorian days.
No,
maybe
I think it isn't as easy as defined. Mm. I think if you're growing up, you know, that your context is probably pretty easy to classify.
Mm-hmm.
you know, where you end up, you know, whether you're a builder earning 100 grand a year or you're a teacher earning 40, yeah. mm-hmm. actually the outcomes are very different. And, you know, fortunately, we're, you know, looking at, you know, young people between the ages of 18 and 30 yeah. and where they've come from, we know limits their life chances. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's wrong. And, you know, in a small way with an industry that once you're in is doesn't care.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing. You know, once you're over that hurdle of getting in, everybody is you know, very relaxed about where you come from. And there's yeah. not really an old school tie mm-hmm. thing going yeah. on in marketing, in my view. You know, so, you know, we're very, you know, kind of we're lucky in the sense that, you know, we start there. We're not changing the world. You know, we're changing the lives of, you know, a relatively small number of people.
But you're changing the world for them. You know, you're changing the world for those people. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. You know, we get young people into some of the top companies. Mm-hmm. You know, we also have launched a new program where we're coaching employability skills, job hunting and succeeding skills with our group. You know, with really, in you know, kind of in, I suppose, rewarding results.
And I think it's really important. And I go back to, and it's not just here to talk about the good old days for me. And I know from talking to people over the years, though, that careers advice, for example, at schools hasn't necessarily moved with the times. And I go back to the school I went to. Nobody ever said, you know, you should consider a career in advertising or in marketing. It just wasn't anything there. But any passing interest, my mum always says, I used to sit in front of the TV as a kid, more interested in the ads between the programmes than I ever was at the programmes. Mm. And if you look back at everything I'd done throughout early life and career, there was a career in advertising just waiting to burst out of me, but nobody ever said it. I kind of stumbled into it later on, and you're like, oh, that's a thing. Who does that?
Yeah, I mean, I wish there was more aptitude work done on young people in schools, and I wish there were better careers guidance. I think you're absolutely right. It is lacking.
The problem is no one ever grows up wanting to be a careers advisor.
That's true. And I think what I have learnt is that if you build it, they will come, is not the case when it comes to tackling, you know, access to any industry with communities that are less affluent. You have to take the initiatives to them. You know, I think the idea that you can create a website with everything there for them, if they don't know that it's even a possibility, that isn't going to get you there. Yeah. You know, there is a bit of a distribution problem from mm-hmm. a marketing point of view. Yeah. You know, we tend to scoop up the people who are looking for a job in marketing yeah. because that is what we do. But there is a pipeline earlier than that in schools and with young people that you know, kind of can promote the industry. It's not part of the job that the charity I'm in, you know, running takes on, but there is a need for that. And I think the other thing that happens is, which I've heard from many of our beneficiaries, is the, you know, if they are particularly the children of first generation immigrants, there is an incredibly strong focus on those ambitious people wanting their children to be professionals, doctors, lawyers, you know, accountants.
And, oh, and
we Darryl. Had, we had, I know, I mean, we had one young lady who we found who was functionally homeless. I mean, she was sofa surfing.
Right.
And her parents had flung her out at 16 because she wouldn't go into a career in medicine. Yeah. She wanted a creative career. You know, we got her first opportunity, and she is yeah. now working at one of the best companies in the category.
Amazing.
You know, which is very, but you just go, you know, wow, that's harsh.
Well, as a child of a first generation migrant, I remember talking to my granny. I went to university to be a PE teacher. My other love, as well as watching ads on telly, was sport. I went and did a sports degree.
Yeah.
After the first year, made that sports and sports management and marketing because I was like, this marketing thing is much more interesting than the sport thing.
Yeah.
Got to the end of the 3 years and could not face doing another year to do a PGCE to become a teacher.
Right.
And I remember vividly the conversation with my granny, and she was like, so what are you going to do then? I was like, I'm going to go and get a job in sales and try and get into marketing. And she was like, but you went to be a teacher. And you're like, yeah, but you know, but you went to be a teacher. And there was just this kind of, why would you give up on becoming a teacher? Because teacher brings respect. It's everything that she left the Caribbean for.
Yes.
And brought her children over as sort of 5, 6, 7 year olds.
In fact, Is she still around?
No, she died a few years ago, sadly, my granny.
Did she see you succeed and come around?
Yeah. And it took a little while to get her. And when you first job out of uni, struggling your way through, you're like, my granny was right.
Yeah.
But you get there in the end, you know, so. But
yes.
It's, you know, what I think when they left and the struggles that migrants went through in the 50s and the 60s and 70s, probably even now, right? Like, you know, it hasn't gone away.
But
some of the struggles of early migrants of the Windrush generation and problems getting housing and problems getting respect in communities and all that sort of thing.
Yes.
When you have a grandchild or a son who's in, you're going to be a teacher, that's a position with respect. Or you're going to be a doctor, that's a position that confers everything that we always hoped we would get.
Yes.
And you just throw it away because you want to go into doing what? Doing funny things on the telly.
Yes, I think that, you know, the earning potential is one very strong argument, you know, for helping to convince the families of people who perhaps don't realise that it's a, you know, a job with tremendous, you know, upside. You know, the salaries are good. You know, there is a pathway to the chief executive via that discipline. You know, I think the prospects in good marketing jobs actually are sort of not always, you know, your young people who want to take that step are not always equipped to you know, challenge why be a teacher versus why be a marketer, you know. And, you know, the sense that it's... you know, a decent living, but also a decent thing to do. You know, it's part of what makes the you know, the economy go round. You know, if you believe in commerce, you know, and business as a you know, a good thing in a country, then why wouldn't you want to go and work in business? And it's a big, you know, driver of business success. But I don't suppose, you know, many, you know, sixth formers faced with the wrath of a fair... A grandmother.
Yeah. What are you doing that for?
Oh, God, if you could harness those nans. Wouldn't it be fantastic?
As a complete aside, there's, I'm sure it happens in other places, street angels. My mum used to do this, and an auntie who's not actually an auntie, but does it basically, nans who go and stand out on the street on a Saturday night and just...
Scoop up the drunk.
Yeah, scoop up the drunks, defuse fights and that sort of thing.
Yeah, we used to have them at the end of the road.
It's like you can be as angry as you like and you're going to start a fight and then somebody's nan taps you on the shoulder.
You see, I think if they were street nans, they would inspire a lot more respect from everybody. I think angels suggests a level of compassion that may be slightly lacking in the real power of a nan.
Oh, actually, to use the London vernacular, a road nan as opposed to a road nan.
Yes, we want. I'm inviting. Let's get the road nans out.
I'm going to see if the URL's available and we'll launch that.
Absolutely.
Coming to a street near you soon.
Absolutely.
So you run, let's keep going. You run the charity.
Yes.
And you've moved from an executive career into a non-exec and a board career.
Yeah.
What's that like, moving away from... Is it a different pressure? Is it just as pressured? Is it different? Is it easy? Is it difficult?
Yes, all of those things. I would say, I think the biggest difference, I think, is the lack of day-to-day stress, if you like. Mm-hmm. I think there is an enormous amount of responsibility, but less day-to-day pressure. Mm-hmm. However, you know, if something goes wrong and you are a director of that company, then you really feel the heat.
Yeah.
And I had a situation, you know, kind of a little while ago where there was a drama and I really felt the heat of that.
Yeah.
So I think it's a different kind of pressure. It's a lot of responsibility and accountability. Mm-hmm. You don't want to overreach and start to tell the executive team what to do. That's not what you're there for. But ultimately, you know, you're responsible for the conduct and the delivery of that organisation. If you're if you have that fiduciary duty, so it's a very different kind of pressure. You know, I was just getting to a point where I wanted to live more and work less, and I think the you know, that is the, you know, you get depending on how many you take on, you have more time. I think you have a bit more agency over your own time, apart from the defined board meetings, mm-hmm. which are set up every year. You know, I think having agency over my own time was particularly important to me. The one thing I find quite challenging about it, of course, is it's sort of quite stripy, if that makes sense, because you've got, you know, I have at present four roles. Mm-hmm. Is it four? Might be five. I know five, actually. And they're all completely independent of one another. Right. So something happening in one part of my universe doesn't necessarily prompt me to remember something in another.
Gotcha.
So, you know, I've had to become much better at writing to-do lists and making sure, and you know, but I do forget things, mm-hmm. you know, because it's very, I'd say, stripy, laminar, yeah. vertical, however you describe it. You know, you're one minute you're doing all about, you know, this, and then suddenly you have to slip into something completely different.
Yeah.
You know, the terribly elegant gala fundraiser for the Academy of Ancient Music, where I'm a trustee, you know, versus, you know, we have an apprentice who can't turn up for work on time in the Marketing Academy Foundation, you yeah. know. So, you know, those things are so completely disconnected that you run the risk, as I do, of occasionally forgetting things. So I've got to get better at my
to-do list.
And managing that practically, but I do enjoy it. I really enjoy it.
So when you made that jump from kind of an executive career into non-exec career, you use a really interesting phrase for the end of your corporate career.
Yes.
And can we talk about why you use that phrase a little bit as well?
Yes, I always say that I ran screaming from the corporate room, which I suppose is more to be funny than that it was, you know, massively true. But I did. I had had enough mm-hmm. of roles that are incredibly demanding and fill your waking moment almost every day. I was quite good at protecting my leisure time at weekends. Yeah. I'd had enough of that full on, full time, no respite. And I think it's getting worse, and I don't think it's healthy for people. Mm-hmm. I just wanted more life and less work.
Yeah.
Now, when I did run screaming from the corporate room, I didn't really have a vision for what my next phase looked like. And people said, how did you come to do what you do? I sort of like to quote Michelangelo, if that isn't awfully pompous, who was asked, how did you create that? Allegedly. Who knows? How did you create the sculpture of David? He said, I just chipped away the stone that doesn't look like him. And I feel slightly that when I sort of, you know, stopped my corporate job, you know, and income, like nothing, you know, to where I am today, you know, I sort of tried a few things and didn't like them, you know. So it was like, you know, I did quite a bit of consulting and I really didn't like it. Now, I do some, yeah. but very, very depending on what's required and very selectively. You know, I tried this and I tried that, and I started to sort of chip away the bits of stone that doesn't look like Daryl's new career and go, yeah, I really like that. And then I did a thing which actually was recommended to me by one of our wonderful trustees, Emma Harris, who's a great believer in the sort of manifesting, mm-hmm. You know, part of figuring out what's right for you. And she did a day's course for one of our apprentices. And, you know, she recommended this sort of visioning exercise. And I thought, well, I'll give that a go. Why not? And I did it properly. And actually, I had... you know, a blinding flash of insight in that process that I liked either very defined and specific engagements mm-hmm. Or complete agency over my own time. And what I don't like is being asked to jump on a call tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock because, you know, somebody somewhere is in a flap about something. Now, of course, if the factory's burnt down or there is some major problem, I'm more than happy to do that. But, you know, given that I have got some degree of choice in what I'm able to do, you know, I realise that I like the board because it's very regular and very defined. I like working from home, you know, 2 days a week to run the charity because I can pick and choose when I work. Mm-hmm. You know, I end up probably mostly doing more than my paid full time. So that works for me brilliantly, but it took me about 4 years to get to that point of stone chipping and screwing up and spinning things I didn't enjoy.
I think there's a lesson to tie that back to what we talked about talent and diverse people coming in into the industry. But I think one of the things that you hear when you talk to younger people is that they almost feel like they have to have this really clear vision of what their career is going to look like. And it's great to hear that someone with a really successful career behind them gets to a new point in that, turns a page and like, oh, fuck am I doing now? You know, I love that, you know, because it does feel, I mean, everyone looks from the outside or you look at someone's LinkedIn profile and you're like, such a perfectly manicured journey.
I know. Well, one of the talks I do, which I know that you've heard, is the campaign I'm quite well known for having delivered from the agency side is Dove's campaign for Real Beauty. And you know, when you read the narrative, sometimes it looks like the seamless logic of a bunch of geniuses, and it was not like that at all. We had a bit of an idea where we were going, but it was really like crawling over broken glass to get there. And we did things that were mad, and we did things that were wrong. We did get there in the end, to the point of listening and not listening and being pretty dogged.
Yeah.
You know. But so I sort of, you know, kind of know what you mean, that I think there is an illusion of people who've got it all down and figured out. And I don't think that's true in most cases. Mm-hmm. I really, really don't.
Yeah. We're all just making it up.
Yeah, absolutely. Have a sense of where you're going. Have a plan to, you know, to be in the northwest quadrant of the compass and not the southeast quadrant. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, put in place some actions and things to get you in that direction. Be intentional, but don't get the idea that, you know, you're going to have it all figured out and it's going to turn out as you expect. You know, I mean, I've got myself on video for the Marketing Academy Foundation saying, you know, I want to get this number of apprentices in 1 year, 2 year, 3 years. Didn't do that at all. So thankfully that is no longer in the public domain.
We will find
it. But yes, I know, find it and shame me with it. But, you know, we did get to a certain place. And we go, okay, this seems to have more limits in terms of scope than perhaps we first thought. What else can we do to help more people? So that's why we launched another program. So, you know, it wasn't what we expected to happen.
I think JP Castlin, who was on this podcast many moons ago, but has influenced me more than most people, talks about the stupidity of strategists trying to predict the future. Mm. And he was like, that's not what strategy is. It really isn't. Stop trying to predict the future. You don't know what's going to happen. It's often about reacting to it, but not being reactive.
Exactly. I mean, when we set up the charity, we didn't expect a pandemic and the war in Ukraine, you know, that created total paralysis in the whole of the country, as far as I could see, last year, you know, with the impact on cost of living and so on. So, you know, navigating through that and actually reasonably well, you know, I suppose wasn't what we had in mind. As nobody did. The word unprecedented, we should say.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there'll be people listening going, oh, Daryl did the Dove campaign, let's talk about that. But before I talk about that, you did mention also the Academy of Ancient Music is one of the boards that you have. Now, firstly, wow. Secondly, who knew there was an Academy of Ancient Music? Well, certainly not me.
Yeah.
So how did that come about? What is it, first of all? And don't say it's the Academy of Ancient Music, but what classifies as ancient music?
Well, it's generally music that existed roughly before Mozart, so more you know, traditional and old school classical.
My daughter of 14 would say ancient music is anything from probably before 2015 or something like
probably,
that.
Probably, but you know, in
definitions are important.
And the instruments and the performances are historically informed, so. In a way, what you're listening to is something very close to how the composers would have actually heard that. And what the people that love it will say is that it's actually much more visceral and you feel a more personal connection between the musician and the instrument. And it's actually quite elemental and less a sort of sophisticated wall of sound that you might get with a more modern orchestra delivering the same piece, much more elemental, much more visceral, more human, and actually a more resonant, I suppose. So that's you know, kind of how our the fans of that music experience it. And the reason why I'm sort of doing that, not because I want to just belong to another charity, there's the word Academy in the title. It's like, I'm, you know, we're Academies and A's. All my board appointments have got A's and Academies. I think it was really because I just wanted to do something a bit artsy. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, somebody asked me if I'd like to do it, and I sort of went, oh, that sounds interesting. It wasn't terribly, it was more opportunistic, I think, than strategic.
Yeah.
That's how, and you know, helping them to reinvigorate, you know, the perception of that organisation. I mean, the product is brilliant. Mm-hmm. It's reinvigorating the perception of the Academy of Ancient Music, which sounds all a bit frilly and effete, doesn't it?
I suppose it's one of those, you know, Academy of Ancient Music, and, you know, I'm thinking, you know, suits of iron, armour.
We're all
and
studying
like
lutes.
That. And that type of thing. So I love that. And again, I think this social media world has people thinking they have to be hyper-specialist in just one thing.
Mm.
And I know from talking to you earlier, you have a science degree, not an arts degree. Yeah. You're an author. You've been in a creative discipline. You run charities. You're on an arts board. There's a depth and a texture to talking to you that's just fantastic. But I think sometimes people think in the earlier career, they've just got to be the specialist in a very narrow field to get
yes.
on.
Yes, well, I think, I suppose if I take myself to task over things, it is to try to be a bit more focused sometimes. You know, I think I find almost everything absolutely fascinating. there are a few things I don't, but mm-hmm. but they're rare. And so I have to sometimes give myself a talking to and go, now, hang on a minute, let's try and keep yourself a little bit more mm-hmm. Narrowly focused.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, still working on that. You know, I mean, everybody's still a work in progress, aren't they? And that, you know, that is part of my goal for 2024. I've got a don't do list.
Oh, excellent.
Yes, I have. Not much on it. But I'm working on that. I've got three things on it.
Three things on it. Can I inquire as to maybe the what is on that list? Or would that be,
yes,
would that be impolite to
well,
ask?
Well, one I won't say. One don't do is don't come to London every week.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of my don't do lists. And I think the other one is described in don't take on any more charity trusteeships apart mm-hmm. from those in the homeless space.
Right. No. Well, that's
so I would very much like to you know, continue my orientation mm-hmm. towards state education, you know, kind of disadvantage and poverty. And I want to try and, you know, restrict myself to that going forward.
Excellent. I don't do list. I like the... Yeah, I think I might generate.
I think a don't do list. It's not my idea. I borrowed it. I'm a terrible magpie. But I thought, what a clever idea.
Yeah.
It really does help, I think.
I'm a fan of this. Mm. Okay. So don't do. Well, let's move to do do.
Do do dove.
So we met with you talking about the Dove campaign. And
yes.
Again, there'll be a link. There must be something online we can link to talk about the Dove campaign. If you're thinking, what Dove campaign? There'll be a link in the show notes.
Yeah.
But it's run for many, many years in various forms, hasn't it? But you were there at the beginning.
Mm, yes, and I'm one of the very few, actually. I think there were five or six of us at the very, very start of it when we had a blank sheet of paper.
Yeah.
And I think I was the only person on the agency side, because at the time I was working at Ogilvy, that saw it through from the blank sheet of paper to execution in 73 countries. Other people joined the team on, mm-hmm. on the way and contributed massively to that. You know, I sort of continued to champion and own that campaign by doing talks about it, because people seem interested to hear it. And it's quite funny, because it actually first ran in April 2004. So it's nice. Coming up to its 20th anniversary. And you know, in terms of my career, it is the gift that has kept on giving, because I'm still invited to do talks about it. And sometimes I feel a bit like Frank Sinatra singing my way, you know, I'm doing this again. But I think, you know, in a way, you know, having any campaign that has got that longevity, I think is pretty phenomenal. And people seem to like the story, and particularly the story of how we came up with the idea and why we came up with the idea, because there are a lot of myths around it, as you referred to earlier. One of which was that it was the seamless logic of a bunch of geniuses. The other one is it was this Ogilvy woke up one day and decided, wouldn't that be a jape to have curvy girls in the adverts? Mm-hmm. That is not how it began. It was an incredibly strategic campaign with very clear business objectives, and it was a solution to very clear business objectives. And I'm a bit, I'm such a massive advocate for strategic thinking around brands and marketing. And so the opportunity to reinforce this notion that it wasn't just a sort of notion that the agency mm-hmm. came up with that they then had to force Unilever to adopt. It was a total client agency team that was joined at the hip over everything. We were in it together, and it was strategic, and it took quite a while to bring it, to figure it out, get it right, and bring it to life. And I think that story is worth reiterating for the principles as well as the actual, it's a good old story. Makes you laugh, makes you cry. You've seen
it. Yeah, it's beautiful. And I you rarely tear up at a conference listening to someone give a spiel. But I did. There's something in my eye. It's brilliant.
But thank you.
But more than being brilliant for Dove, which I know it has been over the years, and it's won Effies and all sorts of various incarnations of it, but it genuinely changed the whole industry, didn't it? And in that, if you're a younger member of the marketing world and you've just clicked to look at the Dove campaign now in the link in the show notes, and you're looking at that going, yeah, there's curvy women in an ad for a beauty product, so what? These are people who've maybe grown up in a world of
more body positivity.
Body positivity, yes. And gym wear being modelled by larger bodies and different things like that. But when this campaign launched, I mean, the Wonder Bra campaign was what, 95? 96?
Something mid-90s,
yeah. Within a decade of this Hello Boys perfection kind of stuck on billboards, and that's what every woman had to aspire to.
Yeah. Well, at the time, it was described by some, including some magazine editors who got a basket full of letters from their readers, it was described as shocking.
The female body being shot. Imagine.
People of a normal size on a poster in their undies was described as shocking. It was so
disgrace to dignity.
It was. Don't think anybody said that. Very, very radical at the time. We had an interesting discussion about what if everybody copies us. And we were like, well, we have to be okay with that, because our going in position was that, images of perfection damage women's self-esteem, proven by psychologists, and therefore if everybody copies us, happy days. So we were okay if people copied us. What did surprise me anyway was that it took probably 15 years before you see much, much more of that. And you've seen it from brands, more contemporary brands like Boohoo and other, Vogue and other, absolutely sort of at the pinnacle of fashion and beauty, taking on a slightly more diverse representation. It took a while.
It took
a while. But I think what is good about Dove, and I'm not involved anymore, but keep a close eye on it, is because the insight was so very fundamental, they're able to evolve and adapt it depending on whatever is unhelpful to women's self-esteem in the external world now, and how social media is impacting the views of young girls. And now you've got retouching in the hands of almost everybody. How people are presenting themselves and how young girls feel about their bodies and their looks and what and so on. So I think they're able to reinterpret that insight for a more contemporary context. Just having somebody, with E-cup boob size on a poster is probably not going to be as radical as it once was. but actually there's plenty more stuff that's going on that is having a deleterious effect on you know, how young girls feel about themselves. And Dove is smart enough, and the Unilever team are smart enough to continue to fight that good fight.
But there's the really interesting thing about that, and you talk about the Unilever team and the Dove team.
Yeah.
But let's be honest, over 20 years, I'd be amazed if anyone is still on that team who has been on that team the whole
there
time.
Is. Yeah, no, there is.
Oh, there is. Yeah. There's someone there. Yeah. Oh, you've ruined my point. The point I was going to make generally is that marketers and brand managers and chief marketing officers tend to move through things fairly quickly, 2 to 5 years or so. And one of the easy things to do is to come in and put your own stamp on it and change it.
Of course, of course.
So that team must have, even though there's maybe some people there, there must have been a lot of throughput of people who at every point have gone, the way to make my career is to make this better. When actually sometimes the best thing to do is to just say, the way to make this better is for me just to shut up.
Yes.
And just to let it carry on.
Yeah. No, I think that's a very you know, good critique of the marketing industry overall. And the worst reason to change a campaign is because you've got a new marketing director. Yeah. And this is another, you know, sort of big critique I would have of the industry, that, you know, consistency of brand over time is really helpful. Mm-hmm. And being consistently wrong is unhelpful. But, you know, so you have to know when to change and when not to change. But Unilever generally have some quite stringent guardrails and governance around teams mm-hmm. changing campaigns. So, you know, they're a very strong marketing-led organisation, and, you know, if they put somebody new in, they wouldn't be allowed to do that on a whim, which doesn't apply in many, many cases in business. Interestingly, the person who was part of the team from the very beginning is a lovely gentleman called Alessandro Manfredi, and he has just been reappointed in the last year or two back to lead the brand. Having had a sojourn in ice cream at Unilever in between. So, you know, interestingly, there is somebody who was there at the very beginning. But I think the reason it's maintained its consistency largely is because the brand strategy is decided upon very thoughtfully and isn't changed on a whim at a company like that. And that is right.
And you, I'm aware that you know Rory Sutherland, previously of this parish.
I do.
Rory said in the last episode of the podcast he was on something along the lines of insights are the rocket fuel of marketing, or something along those lines. And you mentioned that this whole campaign came out of insights. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned really early on about marketers and people in agencies not being given enough time in their job to be trained properly in their job to be able to do these things. With those two things, is one of the things that suffers people understanding what good insight looks like, or understanding the difference between data and then drawing insight from that? Is that one of the things that suffers when we make marketers really time pressured, that they then start just making bad decisions based on incomplete or bad data?
Yes, I think that would absolutely be the case. And you know, I have in the past done a training course around insights and what's a good one and what's not a good one. And, you know, in most instances where things are not going well, it's often because those, you know, practitioners who where that's happening don't know what good looks like. Mm-hmm. And you have to have the time to, first of all, understand what good looks like. And to get there, we talked earlier about excellence is hard. Well, that might be that you have to take a bit longer, or you have to just work a lot harder to get to something excellent. And I think insight is a much abused term. Now, I think there are various calibers of insight. Some are very deep, very psychological, very emotional, that would underpin a brand strategy for quite some time. Others can be quite small and practical, you know, like, you know, advertising retail offers. It works better in the morning when people are coming to work and can go to the shops than when they're rushing to go home. You know, that is a very practical insight, but it's very, very true. And I think possibly the definition of a good insight is, would that be true regardless of whether we were involved or not?
Yeah.
You know, there are so many insights that are really bad that the customer is just waiting and wanting the product that you've just invented. And it's just a rephrasing of, you know, Anna is a busy mom, 33, you know, who wishes there was a, you know, something that made her ironing more pleasurable. And you go, really? Does that sound like anyone I know?
Show me this, Anna.
No, and you go, that is not an insight, yeah. You know. A better insight might well be, you know, our audience are mothers who sometimes hate their children when they do their laundry.
Yeah.
That would be true regardless of whatever product we've got or whatever.
It comes from having diverse teams of not 20-something-year-old Oxbury-educated chaps doing the decision.
Exactly.
Yeah. There was another interesting point from a previous guest who's a data guy in an agency, Thierry Ngutagori, who said that he hates providing dashboards to teams. Because what that leads to is the teams cherry-picking a data point that supports what they already think and therefore isn't actually benefiting anyone. It's just reinforcing bad thinking. You'd rather talk to them about what they're trying to understand, what they're trying to find out, and then use someone who's slightly disconnected from the project to be able to collect and then give them the useful information or the insights at that stage.
Yes.
Sounds time-intensive, but also sounds like a great way of approaching it.
Yeah, I mean, I really like that approach. And I think, you know, we always have to, you know, be any of us have to be aware of confirmation bias. It's a fundamental human trait. But I think if you are the owner of the data and the insights in a company, you should also take as your responsibility that they're not used and abused. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're not really doing your job well.
Yeah.
And to you know, to not withhold information because that's not a good behaviour, but equally make sure that it's not being used and abused, yeah. I suppose.
And I think the other thing as well, and I don't want to give everyone all the secrets of your Dove presentation, but there is something you did later on to get it over the line. And I'm a huge believer in, when you mention data, people always think of ones and zeros and quant research and that's it. Mm. But the qual stuff, bringing the voice of the customer into the room, I think is hugely important. But it wasn't necessarily customers you brought into the room, was it? Can you talk about that?
Yes, I mean, I think one of the things that is hugely important in landing, a brand strategy internally is getting the organisational buy-in, and that varies depending on how big that organisation is, who you've got to get on board. But it's something that, you know, I've done well and I've done badly, and I can tell you doing it well is better. You know, you really do need to invest the time and trouble in that stakeholder management. Mm-hmm. And particularly with the Dove campaign, because Dove was such a huge brand at Unilever, and because an awful lot of the stakeholders who had to agree to it were men, we had to do that really, really well. We came up with a plan. We found men didn't quite understand the insight in the way that women did. Mm-hmm. We interviewed the daughters of the senior leaders to find out how they felt about their bodies, and we brought that to life for those senior leaders, because men generally just didn't believe that women didn't feel beautiful.
Yeah,
it was a sort of, you know, what's wrong with you? You know, you're far, you know,
you are beautiful. Very, why would you think
exactly,
you're not beautiful?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so that was the sort of the if you like, the stakeholder insight that we had, and we used marketing in a way, internal marketing, to overcome that barrier. Yeah. But it was a workup, you know, it wasn't something we did in 5 minutes. Yeah. It was a big old program, and Unilever invested a lot of time and trouble in onboarding everybody with this strategy. Yeah. And then again, when we actually had the work, you know, we did two major programs of stakeholder management. Now it's a huge organization, yeah. You know, with 400 marketers globally, I think, on working on the brand, you know, so it was a big old effort, but really getting that senior buy-in, because we knew that once it sort of materialized, it was going to be a bit radical.
My 2024 head is, that's not actually what I meant. 2024 head? It is 2024 in my head. That's
okay.
Otherwise, it makes it sound like I'm talking about my forehead.
Perfectly clear forehead for one moment then.
So in 2024, I can just imagine you getting in touch with the brand manager's PA or the chief exec of Unilever's PA and going, just need to talk to his daughter. Can you get her on the phone for me?
Yeah.
Just imagine the look you would get now and be like, absolutely not.
No, I think we benefited from probably, GDPR.
Yeah.
But, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. I'm a great believer in that. I bet if we were really keen to do it, we could have done it.
And the bit I loved, I'd done something slightly different. Slightly similar,
we got the
mums,
by the way. We didn't go and stalk with daughters at school or anything appalling. We actually got the mum's permission.
There's a couple of times I've presented ideas to clients that have come out of focus groups and things like that. Yeah. You can sit for hours and you can tell people and you can show them all the lovely charts and all the lovely graphs, and you get the feeling that they're kind of on the bus with you a little bit sometimes, or they've maybe got no idea what you're talking about. But the moment where you just drop in the 30-second clip of the customer telling them about the problem, when I buy that car and I can't get the pushchair in the boot and it just makes it, and then I'm late for school and it's like... Mm. That's what we mean by that data point there. And you can just see, this, I get it.
Yes,
and the voice of the customer in the room, I think is critical in marketing.
Totally agree. And it's slightly, it's slightly sad that that is what it takes, but we're, you know, kind of bringing that human to life rather than describing them in a PowerPoint slide or a deck. It does help. It really does help. As long as they're really typical, you know. I still, you know, I worked when I was at Mondelez on Milka as a brand, and there's just one customer video we had from some ethnographic research we did, which just brings everything to life for me. And it was just that little clip of video. And, you know, I was on the client side, but, you know, you just go, I get that insight because I've seen that real person doing it for real. And I think that it just makes it real. Relatable.
Absolutely. I don't think it's fair to ask you for an opinion on this, although if you wanted to give one, I would happily listen. One of the last blogs I wrote, I don't write blogs anymore, I podcast instead, but one of the last blogs I wrote was about Mondelez and their lovely humaning position, which I don't know...
What position?
Humaning. They weren't looking for human-to-human relationships. They were a brand... they were going to develop brands that were humaning. And I just remember reading... And you know when you're like... This is utter bullshit. It's like every single word of what was released was bullshit. The video released with it was bullshit. And I don't often do it, but I was like, I just had to clear the diary for the morning. I was like, right. And I'm like, started bashing at the keyboard. And
I think you'd have to look at it and kind of go, is there real, kind of positive underpinning and substance to that? Is it the language or is it the actual intent?
I'm sure that, like, I can't imagine at a company that size you would do something like that isn't research driven and insight driven. But there's a bit where at some point you get to it and you have to then make it into something.
Describe it. Yes. I haven't heard of it, so I'm rather up.
Hopefully it's been sort of taken out the back and had a bolt put through the neck. See, it was a couple of years ago, so maybe it's just been quietly killed. Out the
possibly. Possibly. So, it sounds as though there's some good intent behind that, but the language is just, does make you want to reach for the sick bag, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, we'll move on from that. We are sat here with the Blue Bible.
Oh, yes.
Does anyone actually call it the Blue Bible?
I don't know, actually. I mean, funnily enough, but when the publisher's first cover designs were designed to look like a St. James's Bible, but we decided against in the end and went for something a little bit more elementary. Yeah. Thank you for the compliment. I'd hope that would be how people would regard it.
So it's The Brand Book, An Insider's Guide to Brand Building for Business. Let me try that again. I might even see if I can edit that out. It's The Brand Book, An Insider's Guide to Brand Building for Businesses and Organisations by Daryl Fielding. Mm-hmm. Why did you write the book? That's the big question. Why did you write the book?
Well, first of all, I didn't want to die before I'd written a book at all. And this is actually the fourth book I've started and the only one I've finished. So that was part of the motivation. Secondly, I was becoming increasingly aware that sort of brand thinking, if you like, was being depositioned in the industry at the top and the bottom of the industry. And I sort of felt I wanted to fight against that because for me, the brand is everything. Mm-hmm. The brand is the combination of product and reputation. There isn't a chief executive in the country, in the world, who wouldn't care about those two things. And the book is very much about you know, taking that as a starting point and then everything you need to do to figure out your brand and execute it. But what I saw happening, which I wanted to sort of, you know, at least try and drag people back from, was first of all, I think a lot of chief executives are sort of possibly positioning it as a little bit as, you know, that's what the fluffy people with the crayons are doing. Mm-hmm. And they've forgotten that brand is about those things, and it's just about the sort of compliance, the logo design, and the more shallow manifestations of the business fundamentals. So I wanted to pull it back to being at the fundamental part of any business or organization's, you know, kind of being. Mm-hmm. Then at the more in marketing at the more junior level, I think you get an awful, because marketing has become so much more fragmented and specialist, you get an awful lot of people who are coming in to do digital specialists. And they're not being taught about the bigger brand picture. They're just being taught about search engine optimization or social media influencing or, you know, data analytics or what have you. And they then come across brand as the sort of the rather unpleasant people with the crayons, telling them that they actually can't do this, that and the other without any idea about why. Mm-hmm. And so they then think of brand as a sort of restriction to creativity and innovation and just a nuisance. Mm-hmm. But if they understood what a brand really is all about and why, they could then unleash their creativity and apply it, you know, in a more brand appropriate way, where it would stand more of a chance of actually flourishing and happening rather than just being told no by somebody. And I think the other thing that happens is as those individuals get promoted and rise up through the organisation, they get to a point where they can't move on because all they understand are the very specific skill set that they have because they've had no training and understanding of the bigger picture of building a business and a brand. So it was really to help them learn about, you know, where their career might go and also how they could understand the brand they work for better and mm-hmm. be able to, you know, bring some of their ideas to life in a way that would be helpful to that brand. So it was sort of tackling this sort of depositioning of brand into the sort of, you know, fluffy people with crayons or the sort of, you know, miserable people with crayons who won't let you do anything to really what I think it is all about, which is a fundamental underpinning of any business or organisation's success.
And do you think that that move that you saw was kind of turbocharged by that explosion of paid Google and Facebook advertising particularly, where they suddenly told you that you could measure everything and therefore you knew exactly what was going to be a success all of the time? I mean, it was never the case, but people believed it. And is that what was kind of, well, we don't need all this because we can just measure ROAS?
Yes. No, I think it was. I think that attitude was turbocharged by that. And I think it's still present to some degree. And I think, you know, it's jolly unhelpful. Of course, all those things matter. Yeah. But, you know, the idea that there's, you know, everything we ever learnt over decades about, you know, customers' emotion and preference and choice mm-hmm. can be completely thrown out of the window now because we're just measuring everything. You know, it can't be right, can it? I mean, there's always a slight, you know, falling in love with new stuff. But, you know, I did attend a conference some years ago at a major tech company. Where one of their staff got up on the stage and said, well, you know, in 20 years, you know, it'll be a completely digital world, which we all look forward to because all the old people who don't do digital will be dead. Now, as one of the older people in the room, I was so shocked. I didn't have the wherewithal to leave and make a fuss.
Yeah.
You put any other protected characteristic other than age in there, it's absolutely unthinkable.
Yep.
So, you know, I think there was this notion that, you know, digital would be the be-all and the end-all, and it is important. Mm-hmm. It's time to get it in perspective, and all the other things we used to do are still as valid, and we just need to integrate them. And some of the best digital brands, you know, that we all admire, your Apples, your, you know, your Googles, your, you know, I don't know who everybody's in love with at the moment, you know, Airbnb or you know, kind of the latest whatever. They're as avid as any other organisation in curating and managing their brand and understanding what the logo is, you know, what it stands for, what its purpose is, what its strategy is, who it's aiming at, what its positioning is. They're avid about that.
I saw a stat the other day, which was, and again, I didn't interrogate the stat. It was more something I was scanning. Yeah. So take this with a slight pinch of salt. But Samsung generally outsells Apple, but not by very much in the mobile phone world or cell phones for the Americans. Apple spends about 30% on advertising of what Samsung spends on advertising to be within fractions of a percentage of what they do. And the point it was making was that actually Apple invests in that in-store experience, the Genius Bar, which is very different to any other. But that's not a retail proposition, it's a brand proposition. And it that's why they can spend 30% less for very similar results to Samsung, because they invest in all those brand touch points.
Yeah.
Packaging, you know, the whole packaging design and product design, it all helps to add that in. And I'm always really wary about talking about Apple and Samsung on the podcast because so few people ever get to work with that type of brand.
But yes,
it's really interesting how they invest in everything along that brand journey, not just let's throw money at advertising. Yeah.
Well, it's absolutely, that's the other bit about depositioning of brand and the idea that brand is all about the advertising. And actually, that was the definition of it when I joined Vodafone UK as the director of brand. And I spent the first 3 months talking at complete cross purposes with all my colleagues. And I finally had a big aha moment where I go, oh, when they say the word brand, they mean advertising. Wow. And it was the biggest brand in the UK. So I was slightly taken aback by that. So part of my job was to get the organisation to have a better comprehension of what brand really means, which is sort of everything we do in a way. And I remember having this conversation with the finance director. I said, you know, the customer spends more time with their bills than they do with our advertising. You know, everything we do is going to create that reputation as well as the product, you know, and that's where it's reputation and product. So, you know, in the book, you know, we'll be talking about the packaging, the pricing, the positioning, you know, the visual identity, you know, and even all other sensory equities that a brand might have. And I think the way Apple is packaged, you know, is a huge part of the creation and curation of themselves as a quality and premium brand. You know, the fact that people video unboxing, you know, you go, there's the real. And you know, packaging may not be desperately important for your brand, but if it is, then you need to make sure that it reinforces
it's often
what
the first
your brand
thing
stands
anyone
for.
Sees for your, of your
if
brand,
you're a
isn't
cheap
it?
And cheerful brand, you should have cheap and cheerful packaging. Yeah. You know, it's not that everything has to be, you know, spangy and luxey. It has to reinforce what you're trying to build as the customer's sentiment towards your brand. Yeah. I think just moving from the idea that brand equals comms or advertising is so important. It's other stuff.
I've been working recently with a car manufacturer. I'm going to have to talk in very vague terms.
Yes.
And not doing the major strategy thing, doing some very lower level thing. And one part I struggle to get my head around is that their price point for their product is significantly lower than most of the people for that type of product in the market, but they are insistent on telling everyone it's a premium product. And I was struggling with this, and I can tell by your eye roll. This is more of a therapy session for me. And their point was that if you get in their vehicle, everything in it is premium and equal to or better than the premium priced product. And I kept asking the question. I said, but you know, price is a creative factor, and people will look at it and just assume there's something not because it is significantly cheaper than the premium one. No, it's a premium product.
They're saying it's a high quality product, and they're just using the wrong words, arguably, potentially.
Yeah, potentially.
But I know what you're saying is, unfortunately, you know, the price of something will create a perception about it, and you know, I have a interestingly a similar sort of conversation in another part of my universe, you know, where, you know, what is their real objection to moving that price point up, you know, or yeah, so it's an interesting conundrum. I know what you mean.
And it's definitely
do they just
not
make less profit? I mean, where does that value actually go? Have they got economies of scale? How could they explain that?
With difficulty to the customer, and I'll tell you off air a little bit more about
it. Yeah,
but yeah, with difficulty to the customer is I think how they're going to do it. I don't, in the end, when we looked a little bit more at a few things, I don't think it's going to be the thing that will hold them back on where they want to go to.
No.
I think they'll get there anyway for a number of other factors. Mm. But it was really interesting because their brand team, who we'd also had a little dealings with, were not involved in that discussion. That was just somebody else. You know, so I was not the brand team.
Yeah, I think that's one of my other sort of big beefs about the marketing industry is, and it's particularly because, you know, brand being depositioned into comms and marketing also in many organisations is just about marketing communications and not about the fundamentals of price, product and other aspects of what a brand is. And what I also see is you see a diminution of commercial skill in the brand teams that end up with them being almost incapable of having a conversation with their commercial brand partners in the organisation, who get furious with them and bully them because they're just the fluffy people with crayons. And what's the matter with you? Go and give us half a pound of awareness because that's what your job is, matey. You know, and I don't find that particular dynamic helpful either. But what the brand people need to do is equip themselves with enough commercial nous to be able to have those conversations if the organisation is structured in that way, and really, you know, bringing that value to those people. And as you say, you know, the brand team weren't even involved in those conversations, and that's part of what's slightly going wrong with the industry and marketing and branding, is because those things are becoming increasingly siloed because those people are losing respect for each other and can't have a conversation. And to some degree, the brand book is trying to tether that. I mean, if I do write another book, it might be called the money book. I don't know, because the whole commercial skills. Yeah. And I know, you know, Mark Ritson with his MBA is also
bangs the drum about this,
that, you know, because I do think it's a developing problem. You know, I used to do a training course for the industry about, you know, writing a good marketing plan, and the first bit of it was about setting objectives. And there'd always be somebody in that course that would go, I don't do percentages. I would be like from The Exorcist. I'm like, well, kiss goodbye to ever being chief executive then, love. You know, did you get a maths GCSE? Yes, well, then you can do percentages. Yeah. We are not talking, you do not need differential calculus to be a good marketer. You need to be able to add up, and you need to be able to do percentages, and you need to be able to interpret data.
Yeah.
So, you know, get with that program, because not being able to do it. And then those very self-same people would describe that they've got horrible people elsewhere in the organisation that are yelling at them. But they lack the skill to have a conversation with those people, you know.
And
so
the language to be able
and
to
if
have
they're
that
the ones going, oh, I don't do percentages, then you can't entirely blame the people who are more percentage driven, who own the P&L for the brand elsewhere in the organisation, for being annoyed. You know, so I do think we have to upskill the marketing industry on the commercials. I really do.
And think Ritson's always very clear on his view of commercials that, you know, the number one job for most marketers in most jobs is to sell more stuff.
Yes.
And get comfortable with it.
Yes.
Because, we've done this.
You've got a job in the arts.
How many more
things
did you sell? I don't know.
No.
You need to find that out.
Yes,
no one's going to listen.
Be on top of your numbers. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I think it's one of my big bugbears when I've worked with some agencies is I tell them to write the reports upside down. The agencies often give clients reports that start with some very lovely big numbers, and we did this, and then buried on page 73 or wherever is the thing that tells you how many more things that they sold.
Yeah. Like,
put that at the top.
Yes.
Put that as a narrow peak at the top, and then explain how you got there and get wider at the
bottom.
That's
really wise
advice. As opposed to starting with all the fat stuff at the top and coming down to the narrow point. Because you give the client the report, what's the first thing they do?
Yep.
Flick back to page. Oh, there's the answer. Just give me
absolutely.
Even if it's terrible.
Yes.
You build trust that way.
Yes, absolutely. Totally, totally agree.
Dear me. So you've said two things about books. You've written this one.
Yes.
And you might write another one called The Wonder Book. But you also said there was four you didn't write. Which one was closest to finishing, or have any of them been anywhere near close to being finished?
Well, I've probably written half a book under a pseudonym about dating in my 50s.
Excellent.
Yes.
Okay. Right.
So,
I'm aware that there's probably only so much you can say on the topic.
There is only so much I'm prepared to say on the topic.
Excellent. Well, look, if that book ever comes out.
The other one I did begin was called, interestingly, looping back a little bit to diversity, but very much about gender diversity and women in senior positions, was going to be called Corporate Geisha, which was really all about roles that are decorative as opposed to having the power in organisations.
Would the men in the publishing company have allowed you to call it that?
Probably not now. I mean, this was a while back. It was very much about what are the power roles in organisations, and particularly with regard to women who sometimes, I think, gravitate to roles that are more in a service capacity rather than those who own the commercials. So that was one of the other books. And I can't remember the fourth, actually.
Oh, interesting.
Unless it went somewhere.
They're never going to get finished. Are they kind of...
I don't think so. I think the one about dating, I think the slightly... You know, the world has moved on slightly, and it did get published online. I just didn't turn it into the book, which was going to tell my husband's side of the story. But
I was at a discussion with a screenwriter the other week. I was just in the audience watching, and a couple of screenwriters, and one of them talked about the creative power of writing something and then just destroying it at the end.
Okay.
And how it's advice that someone had given some children years ago about writing poems, and to just write it and then just destroy it.
Mm.
Because a lot of the time when you're starting to try and be creative, you're so worried about what other people might think of it that you stop yourself. So it's like, just write the thing you want to do, write it, leave it, read it the next day, and then destroy it.
Mm.
And then do it again.
Mm.
And then do it again. And then at some point you'll be more comfortable with what you're doing, that you'll be happy to share it.
Yes.
And I think there is something similarly, yet slightly different in that process of you've half written some of these books, which has probably led you to writing this book. And if you wouldn't have half written them, this wouldn't have appeared.
Yes, that is possibly true. I mean, that's very much writing what I know. And actually, the dating thing was published. It was published online. And the Corporate Geisha never saw the light of day. Yeah. So, you know, maybe that's what I did first. Then I did an online, and then I did a real, you know, a real thwackable doorstep of a book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. and obviously, as I've said many times, there's a link in the show notes to buy the book. So
it's nicely written, she says modestly. I've written it because I wanted it to be completely free of jargon.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted, you know, anybody, maybe somebody who's got a corner shop or who's opened an online bakery, or anybody, I would hope would be able to read it and do something better as a result. So I defy anyone to find jargon in there.
Excellent. So before we wrap up, one last question about Vodafone. Yes. When were you at Vodafone? Our last questions about Vodafone.
Okay, I was at Vodafone from 2013 to 2015.
I'm fascinated about the role of brand management in A, such a big beast,
mm-hmm.
B, a big beast in such a competitive market space,
mm-hmm.
C, it's very strangely competitive, isn't it, that space, in that there's only three competitors, and there's probably only ever going to be three competitors, because there was a merger and an acquisition thing killed about the time you were there.
Yeah.
So it became clear that Ofcom were only ever going to let, at the minimum, four, and nobody else really had the money to buy into the market anyway.
Yeah.
So what are you just essentially looking for, like, fractions of percentages of growth in that world, or how does that work in such a competitive but strangely uncompetitive space.
Yes, well, I think it's interesting because, of course, there are the actual network providers who have the physical infrastructure, and there are four in the UK. There's quite a lot of evidence, actually, despite appearances, that it's one too many, because it's actually quite a capital-intensive business. So you've got the actual network providers, but you've also got the virtual network providers, your Tesco Mobile, your Lebara,
Smarties, Sainsbury's,
all of which are GIFGAF, all of which use one or other of the core network providers. In the UK, it is not a very profitable market to be a network provider, actually. And if you've got four people competing for that business, it actually makes it very, very, very difficult for any of them to make money.
Right.
So actually, three is a better number.
And there's a little bit of that in the marketplace at the minute, isn't
there?
Yes, there's merger on the horizon.
But there's always consolidations, and particularly with people wanting to, you know, bundle in internet provision, television provision. You know, there's bundling and debundling because everybody's trying to figure it out. One of the reasons the UK is a difficult market to make money is because of the planning permission on mast sizes. I mean, it sounds like a really practical thing. When you go on holiday, for example, you'll see much taller masts than you'll see in the UK, you need fewer of them to provide the network coverage. So people never know that. You know, because I've got a science degree, I love all that stuff. The sort of engineering of providing a mobile network is a lot harder than it looks, because you've got to have, you know, wires and masts and airwaves that get to the mobiles. You know, and people can't understand why you can't do it in the middle of a city. Well, it's really hard to do it in the middle of a city because there's loads of buildings getting in the way of
those
waves.
No line of sight.
So, you know, it is actually a very physical thing. Yes, it's a very competitive market. I think the other thing that struck me when I joined, and this was a while ago now, was that you had an industry that grew up with real, supply side bias, because people were suddenly getting mobiles. You had the smartphone and the data. Mostly what the mobile network providers have had to do is just get the bandwidth and provide the linkage as fast as the customers want it. So they've never really had to create demand.
Interesting.
They've just the executive, you know, it's been an exponential growth of that demand without many of the providers of those businesses having to do much to earn it. So you have a management who sort of have been used to growth as a given and cannot understand when that growth saturates. So when I joined, there was a sort of sense of bafflement about why they're not growing. The first step was, I'll tell you what, we'll reduce our prices. And then everybody else copied. This wasn't at Vodafone, it was in the industry. Somebody dropped their prices first, everybody copied them. We've all got the same share, and now we're all earning even less. That was a daft thing to do. So there isn't a senior management culture in that industry that really understands how to innovate and how to grow brands. I'm generalising. And it's a bit the same when any market saturates. You know, I came from Mondelez, where I was vice president of marketing, where, you know, you're working your tail off to drive 3% growth in a mature market like chocolate. You know, and you know how to do that. And then everybody's moaning that they can't grow. I'm like, try me in chocolate, mate. You know, I'll tell you what. And then, of course, they're looking at me going, oh, what does this chocolate bird know about anything? So that was the culture clash.
Oh, it sounds
delightful.
Just do
some more brand, darling. That's what we've hired you for.
Oh, goodness me.
So, yeah, I did improve the adverts and got some semblance of brand understanding into the organisation. So, they're very much, I think, one of my regrets in a way with Vodafone is that they do tend to change their brand theme and campaigns. Every time they change their marketing people, which is pretty frequently, unfortunately.
It's a very interesting sector, a really interesting market.
And I think the fundamental problem is you need somebody who's run Unilever to go and run one of those companies and start getting into the brand thing. You've got it in the handsets. You know, you've got Apple. Yeah. They know how to manage a brand. You know, but in that network, I think you know, it's been such a technical challenge of supply.
Yeah.
You know, operationally, absolutely fantastic. You know, they've got very, you know, Vodafone in particular have quite a military culture, which you sort of need to create the infrastructure that they've had to build since the 80s.
And I suppose trust as well. So what's the phrase? Trust arrives on foot and leaves on horseback or something like that. But if your network starts to fall to pieces and doesn't work, you'll lose market. It doesn't matter what your ads are doing. People will run from you as quickly as they can.
So. Yeah, so it has to be solid. I mean, Vodafone have a lot of corporate customers, you know. And, you know, if their network failed, the country wouldn't function.
Yeah. And that's, it has to.
Yeah. You know, and so the actual capability within the company on that front is awesome. I mean, they're a great company.
Yeah.
You know, they're great at, you know, network provision and ethics. And in many, many regards, I thought they were just brilliant. You know, the brand building wasn't a skill that they'd really needed until recently.
Until you need it, so yeah.
So it's not that, you know, they should have always had it, you know. I imagine if you got a bunch of Unilever marketers to set up a mobile phone network, you wouldn't have such a great result if you had a load of really good military people and engineers.
Yeah. Dear me, never thought of it like that.
So. Yeah, so it's an interesting, you know, organisation. And I really was very, the culture in Vodafone UK was terrific. Yeah. I loved it.
Brilliant. Well, look, thank you very much for that. Let's leave it there. Okay. I've commandeered your time, to use a military phrase, for an hour and a half. So thank you very much for that, Darren.
Thank you for having me on and letting me boff on. It's been
honestly, it's been the fun. Pleasure
thank
is
you.
All mine. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.